Mr. Chancellor, Mr. President, honored guests, graduands, graduates, congratulations on being a part of this great occasion. My wife and I were here doing a bit of summer school 8 years ago when Simon Fraser had only been mentioned as a location, a site, and it's been 8 years since we were in Vancouver, and it seems like an amazing completion of a perfect circle or cycle. While listening to some of the remarks that preceded me, I was reminded of some remarks made by veteran of these occasions, Adlai Stevenson, and I think some of them, or just a few allusions to them, might cheer you. One of his remarks was, "Columbus went too far," and to which he added, "Plymouth Rock should have landed on the Pilgrims." These kinds of little reversals often reveal a new facet, a new insight into things. Yes, he used to say, "Eggheads of the world unite, you've nothing to lose but your yolks." But another item related to this occasion, which I venture to mention again for the sake of lightheartedness, is something that happened when I was last at Kennedy Airport. I was paged and asked to come to the customs. They looked at my baggage again, having looked at it earlier in Toronto, and then asked me, "Are you acquainted with Tim Leary?" And I said, "Yes, I met him." "Well," he said, "what do you do?" And I said, "Well, I'm a professor of English." And they let me go. But as I left, I suddenly caught the cue. Somebody must have heard me say, in the plane or somewhere or other, "I've got to go to Vancouver to get an LLD." And, LSD, but as it were. Actually, as an inner trip, this is much more psychodelicious than anything Tim Leary ever cooked up. Now, this wonderful spot is a perpetual source of amazement to me. I mean, it would take me a long time to get completely accustomed to anything as beautiful as this locale. I think I'm going to have a few things to say that will explain that matter further. We live in an age of programmed environments. It used to be the curriculum that we programmed. Increasingly, we tend to program the total human environment. As a teaching machine, and here is surely a notable instance of this new programming of total environments as a teaching machine, as a way of training perception. The kinds of space here in this area are many, and they overlayer one another with all the magical X-ray qualities of Expo. Expo is another example of a programmed environment. But one of the results of this programming of total environments, of course, is the satellite, the astronautical world itself, which has to be totally programmed. I think Bucky Fuller is fond of saying that the space capsule is the first completely designed human environment, and it has to include the planet as well. Space capsule is a total human environment which includes the planet. You have to send gravitation along with it as part of the programming. Another strange result of this programming of the new satellite environment is that this man-made environment of the satellites now goes around the planet. And the planet becomes the content of a man-made environment. We used to think of the planet as nature. Now nature is contained in an art form. This has some strange results on our psychic makeup. As we put our central nervous system, as it were, outside ourselves by electric circuits, as we invest ourselves with our nervous system, the only place left for nature is in our own consciousness. And what used to be an external world of nature now has to become part of human conscious activity. I don't know how long it's going to take us to get accustomed to this sort of cosmic humanism. It certainly would seem to begin a new age of dialogue between man and his total environment. It has a lot to say to us, and we're going to have to think of some pretty good replies. There were two mice in a nose cone, and one said, "How do you like this kind of work?" And the other one said, "Oh, well, better than cancer research, I guess." One of the results of this extremity, putting the nervous system outside into the environment or as an environment, is that a whole series of surprising flips or reversals tend to occur. It has been observed that any process at all, when pushed to an extreme, tends to assume all the characteristics of its opposite. For example, in education, the whole reversal or flip over tends to be the moving from the world of instruction to the world of discovery. Whereas formerly, the whole stress was on instruction or input. Now the same candidates have to arrange their faculties in order to make discoveries, rather than just to commit to memory or to have imprinted on their brain pans a blueprinted set of instructions. It's like shifting from hot to cool. In a hot setup, in the slang sense, there's very little opportunity for involvement or participation. When you cool it, then there is room for participation. This is like the shift from the world of the spectator to the world of the producer, and this is tending to happen on all sides. In many areas of education and of business, the consumer is tending to yield more and more to a producer relationship. Do it yourself, or you get involved in the making process. And a curious example of a recognition of this kind of change occurred when my friend Tony Schwartz in New York moved into an area, Midtown, 56th Street, and he had a friend in the police force who said to him, "Tony, if you're ever in trouble in this area, never shout help. Shout fire." He said, "You shout help and you'll get nothing. You shout fire and everybody will rally." Now, fire doesn't involve. It's a relatively impersonal, and it's hot. But when you shout help, you're really inviting other people to get involved in your problems. And people are not very prone to do that. Another flip or reversal of our time, and there are many which I won't even think of, is the changeover from commerce to culture. Increasingly, the world of business is becoming a world of higher education and highly trained skills and also of much educational effort and company time. And the whole world built by commerce today is increasingly becoming an environmental culture of its own, of a very rich kind. The clash or the opposition between business and culture is diminishing very rapidly. I wish the generation gap between parents and teenagers were diminishing half as rapidly. Another flip. And this is one that I think we've all had many opportunities to notice, is the great shift in the work area from jobs to roles, R-O-L-E-S. More and more people want a significant relationship to their work, which involves them in depth, and this is really role-playing. It is not just a specialist, fragmented bit of a job. The need for this flip or involvement in the work process is felt at the highest levels of executive work. There are many dropouts in the upper echelons of our society today, and for the same reasons as at the elementary or secondary school level. Many people in highly responsible jobs feel the need for more responsible involvement in decision-making and look around desperately for this. The costumes devised by teenagers are just as ingenious as this instant feudalism, which represents role-playing. You see, feudal costume, like those bagpipes that brought us in here, are tribal, involving, they're corporate, they're not private. The job is private, and the role is not, it's corporate. And people want more and more corporate involvement, and the long hair and the ritual costumes of the teenagers represent this dim groping for role involvement. And it's very baffling to encounter it at your own dinner table. Incredible appearances. The idea of saving appearances, a famous counsel to people in the past, has gone out the window. There is no question anymore of appearances. That's square. Anything resembling a respectable or tidy or neat appearance is an evidence of non-involvement, of superficiality and squareness. Anything resembling a respectable or tidy or neat appearance is an evidence of non-involvement, of superficiality and squareness. Another flip comes to mind apropos of that. That's namely in the world of speed reading, where paradoxically, speed increases depth of comprehension. The speed reader who moves anywhere from 3,000 to 20,000 words a minute is not reading in the old pattern of on one line or one plane at a time. He reads for thought pattern. At high speeds, the thought form of the author emerges very clearly. So comprehension is increased and retention of data also increased. So it's another one of these flips. As our books increase in number, and they will, speed reading rallies to our side as a reversal of all the old book form. And it's only fair to say that speed reading was preceded by speed writing. And speed writing is what we call symbolist poetry, in which you compress an entire book in a few phrases. Mr. Eliot's phrase, "In the Wasteland," a notable example of speed writing or compression, is one of his last phrases in the book, is, these fragments I have shored against my ruin. The fragments in question are symbolic excerpts from the total culture of the Western world and the Eastern world. Speed writing by compression is, of course, demonstrated in many art forms. Picasso, in Finnegan's Wake. Compression, transparency, overlay is a form of speed writing which enables us to cope with a world of increasing complexity and speed. But just to mention a few more of these reversals taking place in our own time, in the world of advertising has shifted from attention getting to the giving of satisfaction. It has puzzled advertisers in their studies of the audience to discover that the people who really read the ads and notice the ads are those who already own the product. They are not looking for information, they are looking for satisfaction. They want to know how they should feel about the thing they already own. And they get huge satisfaction out of reading about the car they own or the icebox they own. But they're certainly not looking for information about where to buy an icebox. Another notable reversal of our time, which affects us all deeply, is the shift in the movie entertainment world from pictures to the TV world of the X-ray in depth. The picture, the movie camera took us outside into the world around us on an adventure of touring and discovery. TV goes inside us. It's an inner trip. Long before LSD, TV discovered the inner trip. In TV, you are not a camera going out into the world. You are a screen receiving images in depth. You are being penetrated at all times by electric currents. And our youngsters in the past 10, 12 years, under the influence of TV, have undergone total transformation and outlook on the world. They now look for depth. They're no longer satisfied with ordinary approaches. And in the schoolroom, they betray their impatience by insisting on a much more complex and sophisticated approach to subjects. I have a friend in Toronto who says, my kids, when they got to grade one, had already lived two or three lifetimes. They traveled much further than their grandparents in their whole lifetime. And when they get into the classroom, they're given the same old treatment that they were getting long before television, which baffles them. It bewilders them. They really think it's some sort of a trick, that the adults are just putting them on. The X-ray world is a world of mosaic. The TV screen is a mosaic. Innumerable small dots, the light impulses going straight at the viewer. The painters and the artists of the past 50 years have been painting the TV experience long before there was any TV. The artist's job is to study the present and to report what's really happening there and giving people sort of a breathing time before the thing really hits. The TV form of experience, of X-ray, of depth experience, was being given to us by French painters like Seurat, by Paul Klee, by Picasso, and so on. These are abstracts. The X-ray world is a world of abstracts, not of pictures. It's not a world of connections. It's a world of mosaic. Your own newspaper page is a sufficient example. Any newspaper is a mosaic of unconnected items. The only connection between the items in the newspaper is the dateline. It's a totally irrational mosaic. If you tried to connect any of the items in a newspaper, you'd just find yourself writing editorials. The newspaper experience itself involves the reader because it is not connected. It is discontinuous. The moment it's connected, then the reader is left outside looking on at an editorial. The electric speed-up of information in our environment creates mosaics everywhere. Expo is merely one manifestation of a mosaic pattern that responds to this electric environment. Electric speed-up creates an all-at-onceness, a togetherness of factors and experiences that can only be coped with by a mosaic pattern of juxtaposition. And this is quite the opposite of the old method by which you made sense by connecting things. You know, I don't follow you. I don't get your drift. The suggestion that the meaning of these things is really in the connections between them. Well, there are no connections, so that isn't where the meaning is. The meaning is in the pattern. Pattern recognition becomes the sole means of learning in an electric age of speed. You have to be able to spot patterns instantly. And roles, as compared to jobs, represent this kind of pattern. The pattern is not a point of view. When you see a pattern, you don't have a point of view. You are not saying, I think that's good, or I think that's bad. This baffles people brought up on the old fixed point of view culture, in which you were not participant, but merely detached, merely objective, and in which you were not involved, and in which you established yourself by a fixed point of view. And when you had reason to change your point of view, you did so. But with pattern recognition, you don't have a point of view. Perhaps one of the most startling flips or reversals in our world today is the movement of our Western world eastward, and the even faster and greater movement of the Eastern world westward. The East is going west, helped along by old technology like bombs and planes. This is a great educational program, as it were, by which we hope to westernize the East. Like fighting on the old Indian wars, General Custer style. Meantime, by electric means, we are orientalizing the Western world very rapidly. And I personally don't consider this a good thing. On the other hand, it is of such vast, the pattern is so vast that a merely private comment would seem absurd. Instead of looking in the rearview mirror, as mankind has done for countless centuries, even primitive man lived in what he called the cycle of perpetual return. Everything returned, everything repeated. And this pattern of perpetual cyclic return and repeat of world in time created in primitive man a sense of security. Just because it had all happened over and over again, he felt better. Now, when we begin to move at electric speeds, this repetition pattern no longer works. We begin to realize that we're living in a unique time and space, and we tend, instead of looking in this mirror of historical repetition, we tend to go through the looking glass with Alice into a world of space-time in which everything seems rather cockeyed. James Joyce has a phrase, all space in a nutshell. Meaning all space now, without any future or past, an eternal present. Electrically, we are compelled, as it were, to live in an eternal present of total involvement. We go right through the looking glass and make our own space in our own time. The herb, it orbs, we read in Finnegan. The city becomes planetary in its dimensions, and the planet becomes a small city. Harvey Cox, in his well-known book, The Secular City, insists that we have left the world as space and moved into an all-at-once nutshell of the world as time. The Greeks said, know thyself. Confucius said, behave thyself. Zen Buddhism says, express thyself. Christianity said, and says, change thyself. Thank you.